it's a little unreasonable to expect us to resolve everything in 18 months.
Myanmar cautions solving Rohingya crisis will be slow. It's Friday, September 8th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, defending human rights in China becomes more difficult. China gaining ground in the sea. A reorganization for the headquarters of U.S. diplomacy. Technology to create fresh water and recycle energy. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Myanmar State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi says it is unreasonable to expect the plight of the Rohingya Muslims can be solved quickly.
Well, this is one of the biggest challenges that we've had to face, because you know that the situation in the Rakhine has been difficult for many decades. And in fact, it goes right back to pre-colonial times. And I think it's a little unreasonable to expect us to resolve everything in 18 months. As you know, that we have all been in the administration only 18 months. We're trying to progress as quickly as possible on the development front.
But she says everyone who's in Myanmar, also known as Burma, whether they are a citizen or not, must be cared for. She said it's their duty and, given limited resources, will do their best to carry that out. Wednesday, in a statement, Aung San Suu Kyi said the violence in Western Rakhine State was being fueled by a huge iceberg of misinformation that is promoting the interest of terrorists, a reference to insurgents who attacked security forces, prompting a two-week crackdown believed to have killed hundreds. Nearly 150,000 Rohingya civilians have fled across the border into Bangladesh, creating a storm of criticism from the Western and Muslim worlds. Francis Wade is an independent journalist and author of the book Myanmar, the Enemy Within, a reference to Buddhist violence aimed at the Rohingya. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the problem is the Myanmar government has yet to engage in the issues Aung San Suu Kyi has raised,
such as marginalization of the community, tight restrictions on the movement of the community, their statelessness. These are issues she hasn't addressed. And the problem is that they've led to this sort of simmering tension that's now exploded into violence. Hence, we have this armed insurgency on the Rohingya side, and on the government side, fairly indiscriminate, apparently quite brutal counterinsurgency campaign. So while I do understand that the problem is very complex, there had been warnings going back years, decades even, that something very, very worrying could happen there. And that's what we're seeing now.
Given the political structure of Myanmar, is it fair to say that Aung San Suu Kyi's hands are somewhat tied by the military, which acts pretty independently?
She is in a very difficult position when it comes to the military. When her civilian government came to power, it only did so because she acquiesced in a power-sharing agreement with the military. So there's this narrative that Myanmar is now transitioning towards democracy, that a civilian government has taken the reins. That's not really true. The military is still a very significant power holder in the country. And she fears that by criticizing the military, then the military will interpret that as a bid to sort of take control of the country's defense portfolio. And that is one of the major points of leverage that the military has in national affairs. So she fears that should she antagonize the military, then the military will respond in kind and make life very difficult for her civilian government.
Well, on Wednesday, in a statement on her Facebook page, she made some rather interesting remarks, saying that the treatment of the Rohingya is being fueled by what she called a huge iceberg of misinformation, which she blamed on the Rohingya Muslims.
There's certainly a propaganda war going on that's being fought by both sides. I think that's common in any nascent conflict. The problem is we've had, from the government side, very irresponsible statements made, not just about the Rohingya, but about, for example, aid workers assisting the Rohingya insurgency, which is baseless. The other problem is the government and the military has heavily restricted media access and the access of any independent observers to the conflict zone. So it's impossible to know what's really going on. And because of that, rumors start to spread. So in a sense, the government hasn't really helped itself. And it's very difficult, I think, for it to blame the campaign of misinformation when it hasn't allowed accurate information to be released.
Francis Wade said while it may be difficult given the power-sharing agreement, Aung San Suu Kyi's government must find a way to influence the military on the crackdown. Further, the international community must put pressure on the Myanmar government, especially the West, which he said fell for the idea of a smooth transition. He said, "We've entered a new dark period, and it's time for the international community to recalibrate its policies toward Myanmar." The United States is expressing deep concerns and says it's in close contact with Myanmar's government on the situation in that country's northwestern Rakhine state, where tens of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have been forced to flee across the border to Bangladesh. The State Department, however, said it welcomed indications Myanmar's government is committed to providing access to humanitarian aid via the Red Cross. Officials say the UN World Food Program has provided tens of thousands of people with food, including high-nutrient porridge to women and children who are arriving in Bangladesh hungry and malnourished. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. North Korea vows powerful countermeasures to sanctions. China offers support for UN efforts on North Korean nuclear issue. North Korean challenge comes at China from all angles. As Rohingya fills camps, Bangladesh to build one more. Australian High Court clears way for nationwide survey on same-sex marriage. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia, and you'll always find the latest as well on voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. Human Rights Watch has accused China of a campaign of harassment of those who speak out against its human rights record, even extending its reach to the United Nations. Kenneth Roth is the group's executive director.
I think it's widely known that China is going through the most intense period of repression at home since the crackdown on the Tiananmen Square democracy movement more than 25 years ago. But what's not broadly appreciated is how much that attack on human rights monitoring and human rights criticism has extended abroad, particularly to the United Nations.
Roth said China is really trying to undermine the UN human rights system. He said Beijing appears to want to turn the clock back 70 years before adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And he said the United Nations has been fairly quiet about it.
You will see, for example, Chinese diplomats actively photographing activists who are trying to lobby the Human Rights Council in clear acts of intimidation. But sometimes at even higher levels, when the president, Xi Jinping, came to Geneva in January to speak to the United Nations, the Palais des Nations was basically shut down. You know, 300 UN staff were sent home. NGOs were not allowed to be present. And it was as if the UN was complicit in Xi Jinping's, you know, insatiable desire for public acclaim and his antipathy to any public criticism.
The Human Rights Watch report, titled "The Costs of International Advocacy, China's Interference in the United Nations Mechanism," is based on dozens of interviews. In Hong Kong, Human Rights Watch researcher Maya Wang tells VOA China is known to have harassed UN rights experts and staff when the topic of its own human rights record comes up.
Another aspect of this is the Chinese government prevents civil society actors who are critical of China from traveling to the UN to speak, including filming and intimidating them once they are at the UN. A particularly notorious example is the activist Tao Shunli, who was prevented from traveling to the UN to attend a training and subsequently died following custody. The report also focuses on how this is not just a problem for civil society actors inside China who work on China, but because of the Chinese government's growing clout internationally and the Security Council status, some of these actions by the Chinese government could undermine the human rights mechanism, the importance of protecting human rights worldwide. And we can see the beginning of such efforts, for example, the Chinese government taking more assertive actions to undermine initiatives at the UN that push for a stronger role for civil society and human rights defenders.
She says activities once acceptable for defending human rights in China have now become outlawed under Xi Jinping's tightening control.
Over the last 3 years, ever since the presidency came to power in 2013, he has intensified the crackdown on human rights defenders. This kind of hostility has reached new heights on the presidency. The presidency has strategically focused his effort to dismantle particularly effective groups of activists, including human rights lawyers, but also increasing control over the internet, which has been very useful for ordinary people to voice their grievances, as well as taken to further control domestic press. There have been many efforts across the board in China that the government has been taking to reduce human rights activism inside China. And often this kind of campaign that the government focuses on individuals who in the past were able to do this kind of activism, but now they're being thrown in jail for doing things that they were able to do before, like going defending clients who have been accused of political crimes.
The New York Times quotes a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman as saying the reports of accusations are groundless. He called on the group to remove its, quote, tinted lenses and objectively and justly view China's human rights development. Happening now in Asia, an Indian court sentenced two men to death Thursday for their involvement in the 1993 bombings in Mumbai that killed more than 250 people. A third key figure in the attacks was given a life sentence. The men were arrested several years ago after the coordinated attacks using 13 powerful bombs to hit high-profile targets. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks for visiting and spending some time with us. Countries with competing claims to the South China Sea have failed to start joint resource projects, with the strongest one, China, despite discussions over the past two decades, as they fear unequal results or a loss of sovereignty. Frontline countries in Southeast Asia worry that they would take a minor role compared to China or end up ceding marine resources because China is bigger and more advanced. China, in turn, may suspect that domestic politics in a democratic country such as the Philippines could disrupt a deal, experts say, like Andrew Young, Secretary General of the Chinese Council of Advanced Policy Studies think tank in Taiwan.
Other countries still expecting Beijing will be more of a responsible stakeholder in terms of their performance and behavior in the South China Sea.
The South China Sea is rich in fisheries as well as fossil fuels. China and Taiwan claim nearly the whole sea. Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines call as their own parts of the sea extending from their coastlines. Over the past decade, China has upset other countries by building artificial islands for military use and passing Coast Guard vessels through contested tracts of the sea. Southeast Asian nations worry their populations would see deals with China as concessions of sovereignty. Fabrizio Bizzato, a Taiwan Strategy Research Association fellow specializing in Asian political issues, says China has clear advantages and leverage.
The problem is that China wouldn't bend over backwards. They have the means, they have the resources, they have the technology. It will be a China plus kind of cooperation.
China's unilateral mid-year fishing moratoriums in the northern parts of the sea have already given other countries a sense of non-cooperation. Distrust of Beijing runs deep among common people in Vietnam, which suffered anti-China rioting in recent years, and the Philippines, where opinion polls have consistently shown a majority with misgivings about China, despite Manila's efforts since mid-2016 to improve ties with Beijing. And analysts like Colin Koh, Maritime Security Research Fellow at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, say China may fear legislators in democratic nations could scuttle any cooperation as well.
There's still this level of distrust, and I think China will still find it very difficult to overcome those domestic sentiments within those governments, no matter what it puts out.
China tends to resent third parties as foreign influence in bilateral deals, and so some experts say Southeast Asian governments may prefer a third-party enforcer, such as a United Nations agency, for any deals with China. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for sending us this story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Pakistan has vowed to stay engaged with the United States to help fight terrorism in neighboring Afghanistan, but said the war cannot be won by excluding or confronting Islamabad. U.S. President Donald Trump criticized Pakistan when he announced his long-awaited Afghan war policy last month. Stop by VOA Asia Facebook anytime for the latest news and features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, how would the United States respond to concerns from North Korea's missiles and China's growing involvement in the South China Sea and many other issues in Asia as the relatively new Trump administration continues to evolve? Well, now the top U.S. diplomat, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, has pledged to carry out a major reorganization of the U.S. State Department. The chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Ed Royce, was on hand as several former ambassadors and business leaders launched a report with recommendations for State Department reform at the Atlantic Council Research Institution. It's a bipartisan group of experts and says it's essential to empower the department at a time of rapidly changing global challenges and threats. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has the story from the State Department.
House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Ed Royce said he has been clear that he does not support deep cuts to the State Department and the Agency for International Development proposed by the Trump administration.
When the administration first announced its proposed cuts of over 30%, I expressed my concerns and said we should be supporting, not slashing, anti-terrorism, law enforcement, humanitarian programs, given the growing threats that we face.
Royce called on Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to move quickly to fill the many vacant senior positions, both at the State Department and at U.S. embassies around the world.
The men and women of the department need an effective chain of command in order to implement administration policies and in order to carry out their crucial national security duties.
A bipartisan group of former ambassadors agreed, saying their report shows it is essential to bolster the State Department by reducing the number of bureaus and offices and making training for mid-level and senior staff mandatory.
We cannot afford a weakened State Department. We cannot afford an underfunded, poorly led, inadequately trained, and bureaucratically muscle-bound State Department. We need to strengthen it, restore it, and empower it to do better.
A former senior financial officer at the State Department said diplomatic security costs have skyrocketed since the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks.
We now spend more securing the State Department than we do running the State Department. That is the discussion we need to have.
All of the experts agreed that diplomacy is more crucial than ever in protecting Americans at home and keeping U.S. troops out of harm's way. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Australia's High Court has cleared the way for citizens to express their views for or against same-sex marriage in a nationwide mail-in ballot. The court rejected two separate legal challenges to the proposed survey after 2 days of hearings. Gay rights activists were seeking to scrap the plan on concerns the ballot might stoke anti-gay violence. Make visiting VOA Asia Facebook part of your day. This is VOA Asia. Now, as we continue with VOA Asia, although 75% of our planet is covered with water, many countries around the world suffer from a low supply of fresh water. There's plenty of water in the ocean, of course, but removing the salt is very expensive, and only coastal nations with an ample supply of power, such as the Arab Gulf states, can afford to rely on desalination. VOA's George Pudich reports as sources of fresh water dwindle, emerging new technologies could make the technology more cost-effective.
Surface and underground rivers and lakes, ice and snow, where most of our fresh water comes from, comprise only about 2% of all the water on our planet. And due to overconsumption and climate changes, those sources are overstretched. The rest 98% of the water is in seas and oceans, too salty to be drinkable. But seawater can be desalinated. There are two basic methods to do that. Distillation through evaporation and filtration through special membranes that keep larger salt molecules from passing through. Distillation requires a lot of energy, so it is used mostly in Middle East countries. Membrane-based technology is more affordable, says water resources expert Nikolai Vuchkov, who spoke via Skype.
And membrane desalination, which is the most common technology today, uses about a half of the amount of power that thermal desalination uses.
But there is still room for improvement. In his lab at the University of Virginia, Professor Jeffrey Geis and his students are developing a polymer membrane with better chemical and mechanical stability.
If we're successful in that ends up greatly simplifying the desalination process. There are cost savings in terms of simplifying the process, fewer chemicals to be used in terms of actually running the process.
Other technologies, such as membranes with enzymes and nanoparticles, promise to even more dramatically lower the cost of desalination on an industrial scale.
This type of structure, if we could imagine that we could generate that structure that looks like a honeycomb, we would increase production about 20 times to what we have today.
According to the International Desalination Association, there are more than 19,000 desalination plants worldwide, processing more than 92 million tons of water daily. As the average world water consumption is about 10 billion tons a day, scientists say cheaper desalination processes could certainly lower the pressure on the natural sources of clean water. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Most of us are familiar with the concept of renewable energy, like solar and wind. In addition, they're sources of power that are recyclable. Faith Lapidus tells us how old tires and congealed fat are generating interest and energy.
Millions of discarded tires clog the world's landfills, never decomposing. Unless they are shredded into strips and fed into this machine built by a group of engineering students in Cairo. A blast of fire to heat the container and start the evaporation process, and the tires are transformed into diesel oil and black carbon.
We use diesel oil as an alternative to gas oil in cement or brick factories. We use the carbon or black coal in the production of ink or as a raw material in the production of tires all over again.
It took the team of 12 students 3 months to design the device as a graduation project and another 7 months to build it. They're now searching for investors to scale up their project. Another recycled energy effort focuses on the congealed grease, fat, and other waste clogging sewers and water treatment plants around the world.
Anything with fat that's gone off and rancid and is going to go to landfill, we can now handle that, and we can turn it into energy, into transport energy, and into fuels for trucks and buses.
Argent Energy in Britain uses a multi-step process to turn degraded, horrible, smelly raw materials into high-quality biodiesel. First, the solids are filtered from the wastewater. Then a chemical catalyst transforms the remaining oil-based material into something that can be separated from the water and distilled into biodiesel.
What we do with it now is we will blend it with normal diesel and supply it to bus companies around the country as a sustainable road fuel.
So everyone is a winner in these efforts. The companies doing the recycling, the businesses that use the transformed materials, and the environment. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We say hello to everyone who's listening in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, via Helps Radio at Help University. Thanks for joining us today. You can also find our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Of course, we're on VOA Asia Facebook each and every day, and it's a great way for you to get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, managing editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, and David Bird are part of our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington, and we hope you have a great day ahead.